Chapter 54. Words. They sank into my mind. But the loss of my mother hit me most, and by degrees I was brought to see daylight. Since then my one desire has been to hand on the true view to others, and that is what I was trying to do today, though it is only lately that I have preached here about. The first months of my ministry have been spent in the north of England among strangers, where I preferred to make my earliest clumsy attempts, so as to acquire courage, before undergoing that severest of all tests of one's sincerity, addressing those who have known one, and have been one's companions in the days of darkness. If you could only know, Tess, the pleasure of having a good slap at yourself, I am sure, don't go on with it, she cried passionately, as she turned away from him to a stile by the wayside, on which she bent herself. Can't believe in such sudden things. I feel indignant with you for talking to me like this, when you know what harm you've done me. You, and those like you, take your fill of pleasure on earth, by making the life of such as me bitter, and black with sorrow. And then it is a fine thing, when you have had enough of that, to think of securing your pleasure in heaven by becoming converted. Out upon such I don't believe in you, I hate it. Tess, he insisted. Don't speak so. It came to me like a jolly new idea. And you don't believe me? What don't you believe? Your conversion. Your scheme of religion. Why? She dropped her voice. Because a better man than you does not believe in such. What a woman's reason. Who is this better man? I cannot tell you. Well, he declared, a resentment beneath his words seeming ready to spring out at a moment's notice. God forbid that I should say I am a good man, and you know I don't say any such thing. I am new to goodness, truly, but newcomers see furthest sometimes. Yes, she replied sadly. But I cannot believe in your conversion to a new spirit. Such flashes as you feel, Alec, I fear don't last. Thus speaking she turned from the stile over which she had been leaning, and faced him, whereupon his eyes, falling casually upon the familiar countenance and form, remained contemplating her. The inferior man was quiet in him now, but it was surely not extracted, nor even entirely subdued. Don't look at me like that, he said abruptly. Tess, who had been quite unconscious of her action and mien, instantly withdrew the large dark gaze of her eyes, stammering with a flush, I beg your pardon. And there was revived in her the wretched sentiment which had often come to her before, that in inhabiting the fleshly tabernacle with which nature had endowed her, she was somehow doing wrong. No, no. Don't beg my pardon. But since you wear a veil, to hide your good looks, why don't you keep it down? She pulled down the veil, saying hastily, it was mostly to keep off the wind. It may seem harsh of me to dictate like this, he went on, but it is better that I should not look too often on you. It might be dangerous. SSH, said Tess. Well, women's faces have had too much power over me already for me not to fear them. An evangelist has nothing to do with such as they, and it reminds me of the old times that I would forget. After this their conversation dwindled to a casual remark now, and then as they rambled onward, Tess inwardly wondering how far he was going with her, and not liking to send him back by positive mandate. Frequently when they came to a gate, or stile they found painted thereon in red, or blue letters some text of scripture, and she asked him, if he knew who had been at the pains to blazon these announcements. He told her, that the man was employed by himself, and others who were working with him in that district, to paint these reminders that no means might be left untried which might move the hearts of a wicked generation. At length the road touched the spot called Cross in Hand. Of all spots on the bleached and desolate upland this was the most forlorn. It was so far removed from the charm which is sought in landscape by artists and view lovers, as to reach a new kind of beauty, a negative beauty of tragic tone. The place took its name from a stone pillar which stood there, a strange rude monolith, from a stratum unknown in any local quarry, on which was roughly carved a human hand. Differing accounts were given of its history and purport. Some authorities stated that a devotional cross had once formed the complete erection thereon, of which the present relic was but the stump. Others that the stone as it stood was entire, and that it had been fixed there to mark a boundary or place of meeting. Anyhow, whatever the origin of the relic, there was and is something sinister, or solemn, according to mood, in the scene amid which it stands, something tending to impress the most phlegmatic passerby. I think I must leave you now, he remarked, as they drew near to this spot. Have to preach at Abbot's Cernal at 6 this evening, and my way lies across to the right from here. And you upset me somewhat too, Tessie. I cannot, will not, say why. I must go away and get strength. How is it that you speak so fluently now? Who has taught you such good English? I have learned things in my troubles, she said evasively. What troubles have you had? She told him of the first one, the only one, that related to him. D'Urberville was struck mute. Knew nothing of this till now, he next murmured. Why didn't you write to me when you felt your trouble coming on? She did not reply, and he broke the silence by adding, well, you will see me again. No, she answered. Oh, not again come near me. I will think. But before we part, come here. He stepped up to the pillar. His was once a holy cross. Relics are not in my creed, but I fear you at moments far more than you need fear me at present, and to lessen my fear, put your hand upon that stone hand, and swear that you will never tempt me by your charms or ways. Good God, how can you ask what is so unnecessary? All that is furthest from my thought. Yes, but swear it. Tess, half frightened, gave way to his importunity, placed her hand upon the stone and swore. I am sorry you are not a believer, he continued, that some unbeliever should have got hold of you and unsettled your mind. But no more now. At home at least I can pray for you, and I will, and who knows what may not happen. I'm off. Goodbye. He turned to a hunting gate in the hedge, and without letting his eyes again rest upon her, leapt over, and struck out across the down in the direction of Abbot's Cernal. As he walked, his pace showed perturbation, and by, as if instigated by a former thought, he drew from his pocket a small book, between the leaves of which was folded a letter, worn and soiled, as from much rereading. D'Urberville opened the letter. It was dated several months before this time, and was signed by Parson Clare. The letter began by expressing the writer's unfeigned joy at D'Urberville's conversion, and thanked him for his kindness in communicating with the parson on the subject. It expressed Mr. Clare's warm assurance of forgiveness for D'Urberville's former conduct, and his interest in the young man's plans for the future. He, Mr. Clare, would much have liked to see D'Urberville in the church to whose ministry he had devoted so many years of his own life, and would have helped him to enter a theological college to that end. But since his correspondent had possibly not cared to do this on account of the delay it would have entailed, he was not the man to insist upon its paramount importance. Every man must work as he could best work, and in the method towards which he felt impelled by the Spirit. D'Urberville read and reread this letter, and seemed to quiz himself cynically. He also read some passages from memoranda as he walked till his face assumed a calm, and apparently the image of Tess no longer troubled his mind. She meanwhile had kept along the edge of the hill by which lay her nearest way home. Within the distance of a mile she met a solitary shepherd. What is the meaning of that old stone I have passed? She asked of him. Has it ever a holy cross? Cross no, twere not a cross. Is a thing of ill omen, miss. It was put up in wild times by the relations of a malefactor who was tortured there, by nailing his hand to a post and afterwards hung. The bones lie underneath. They say he sold his soul to the devil, and that he walks at times. She felt the petit mort at this unexpectedly gruesome information, and left the solitary man behind her. It was dusk when she drew near to Flintcombe Ash, and in the lane at the entrance to the hamlet she approached a girl and her lover without their observing her. They were talking no secrets, and the clear unconcerned voice of the young woman, in response to the warmer accents of the man, spread into the chilly air as the one soothing thing within the dusky horizon, full of a stagnant obscurity upon which nothing else intruded. For a moment the voices cheered the heart of Tess, till she reasoned that this interview had its origin, on one side or the other, in the same attraction which had been the prelude to her own tribulation. When she came close, the girl turned serenely and recognized her, the young man walking off in embarrassment. The woman was Izzy Hewitt, whose interest in Tess's excursion immediately superseded her own proceedings. Tess did not explain very clearly its results, and Iz, who was a girl of tact, began to speak of her own little affair, a phase of which Tess had just witnessed. "He is Amy Seedling, the chap who used to sometimes come and help at Talbothays," she explained indifferently. "He actually inquired and found out that I had come here, and has followed me. He says he's been in love with me these 2 years. But I've hardly answered him." XLVI, several days had passed since her feudal journey, and Tess was afield. The dry winter wind still blew, but a screen of thatched hurdles erected in the eye of the blast kept its force away from her. On the sheltered side was a turnip-slicing machine, whose bright blue hue of new paint seemed almost vocal in the otherwise subdued scene. Opposite its front was a long mound or grave, in which the roots had been preserved since early winter. Tess was standing at the uncovered end, chopping off with a billhook the fibers and earth from each root, and throwing it after the operation into the slicer. A man was turning the handle of the machine, and from its trough came the newly cut sweets, the fresh smell of whose yellow chips was accompanied by the sounds of the snuffling wind, the smart swish of the slicing blades, and the choppings of the hook in Tess's leather-gloved hand. The wide acreage of blank agricultural brownness, apparent where the sweets had been pulled, was beginning to be striped in wales of darker brown, gradually broadening to ribbons. Along the edge of each of these something crept upon 10 legs, moving without haste, and without rest up and down the whole length of the field. It was 2 horses and a man, the plow going between them, turning up the cleared ground for a spring sowing. For hours nothing relieved the joyless monotony of things. Then, far beyond the plowing teams, a black speck was seen. It had come from the corner of a fence, where there was a gap, and its tendency was up the incline, towards the swede cutters. From the proportions of a mere point it advanced to the shape of a ninepin, and was soon perceived to be a man in black, arriving from the direction of Flintcombe Ash. The man at the slicer, having nothing else to do with his eyes, continually observed the comer, but Tess, who was occupied, did not perceive him till her companion directed her attention to his approach. It was not her hard taskmaster, Farmer Groby. It was one in a semi-clerical costume, who now represented what had once been the free and easy Alec d'Urberville. Not being odd at his preaching, there was less enthusiasm about him now, and the presence of the grinder seemed to embarrass him. A pale distress was already on Tess's face, and she pulled her curtained hood further over it. D'Urberville came up and said quietly, "I want to speak to you, Tess." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.